Drums, please. Hi, it's me, Ashkenazi, your favorite North London Jewish queen. I am here to bring to you the secrets from the Pink Room.
Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, with Kenazi. Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room, Pink Room, Pink Room, not the Stink Room.
Hello, my bubblers. It's me again, Ashkenazi, reminding you that every hole is a goal. Welcome to the Pink Room, the queerest backstage since Naomi Campbell last threw her phone. Mid-coronavirus lockdown, I had the pleasure of speaking to none other than my Aussie mother, Holiday Sidewinder. It was such a casual conversation that I forgot how to set up mics and record properly, so apologies for the crappy audio-visual, but I digress. If you don't know who Holiday Sidewinder is, get to know it. Musician, dancer, and one of the most beautiful souls that I have the pleasure of knowing. Amongst reconnecting, me and Holiday discuss our trip to Southampton, Harry Styles, the female experience of touring, and what it means to be an indie musician. So here it is. Holiday Sidewinder in the Pink Room with me, Ashkenazi.
Holiday, mother, esteemed guest, someone that I look up to on the regular, someone who inspires me to be this beautiful.
Oh.
Welcome to the Pink Room.
Wait, thank you. What an introduction.
Let's talk about when we first met, because I feel like it still sticks out in my mind very raw.
I mean, yeah, what a night.
We were in Southampton.
We were in Southampton and I wasn't supposed to be there. Were you performing or not?
No, someone said to me, can you get to Southampton and just be in drag? And I was like, sure, girl. No. Like, get me down. I always love an evening with Mac Daddy. You never know which way it's going to go.
So I used to date Joey in Mac DeMarco for a while. And Lucy, who is my guitarist in the States, was playing with the support act. And I was on a solo tour around Europe. A really miserable solo tour, like my first small European shows, like to 30 people in Amsterdam, like and traveling on my own. It was just kind of intense. No tour manager, nothing, just me. And I got back to London and at like 6 o'clock, Lucy was like, you could just get on a train to Southampton and see us. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm gonna get on a train to Southampton. So I got one of the last trains and I got there, I think, like a few songs into Mac's set.
All I remember was this one chick from the support act running up to me and she goes, oh my God, Holiday's gonna love you. I was dressed, you know, that like Fifth Element white number that Mila wears?
I remember exactly what you were wearing.
So I had it in black and I'd covered myself in blood. Plus, I had this Trump mask and this orange wig. And I don't know, Mac put me in a bin and I like spent a while popping up while people was walking past.
You were quite messy, but fabulous as always.
Well, I think I'm a combination of messy and fabulous. Whereas I always find you're that combination of fabulous and just on point. So I feel like...
It really depends on what day.
But every time I've seen you, you have been dressed to the nines in something that I wanted. So like the first time I met you, you were in full ski suit, huge glasses, big gold chain. I was like, this bitch knows what's up. And then the next time it was like Versace print, orange fur You did Harry Styles at the Grammy before he even knew what he was doing.
Thank you. Yeah.
Have you seen that performance, by the way?
Yeah. And you know what? I don't know why I've like tried to not like Harry, but I was like, damn, he's really hot there.
Yeah.
Like he just is.
Yeah.
Actually met him one night. It was the first party I ever went to in London. My management sent me there. It was like a Warner Brothers, like Brits Awards party. And they're like, here, you just go. And I'm like, by myself? Like, I don't know anyone in London, not one person. And the person that was behind me in the queue was Harry Styles. But I was so uninterested at that time. I was like, you know, from like indie rock background, I'm like, One Direction. Like, you know, I thought I was too cool and I was wrong.
That kind of is an interesting thing that I've never actually spoken to you about was Bridezilla. How did you make that transition from a band who were talked about as like the next Pavement? And at what point did that become something that was too much? Or did you suddenly go, oh shit, I've been missing out on that?
You know what it was in my like childhood, I loved pop music. I was doing dancing and singing like full bubblegum pop era throughout the 90s, which was like prime pop and early 2000s. And then I became a teenager and I became really depressed. And I started listening to like Captain Beefheart and Tom Waits and like, yeah, Pavement. And also I grew up around the kind of Nick Cave scene. And so that was my world then. And I wore a lot of kind of black crepe dresses and like very gothic. And I was just miserable. And I think your music reflects like who you are. Yeah, that was what it was at the time. And then I was 18 and I started seeing a DJ who was like a hip-hop DJ and a rave DJ. And it kind of changed my life. Listening to like Let Me Be Your Fantasy. And at the same time, I was singing with a pop group called Pinyao, who like Elton John had picked up. And I was singing these big pop songs in front of like 40,000 people. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is what I want to do.
Yeah. So at what age did you start Bridezilla? Because if at 18 you were going out with a superstar DJ.
I was 14. So we signed our first deal when I was 14 or 15. And I toured throughout high school.
Wow. And how was that as an experience? I mean, I remember my first tour, I wanted to jump out of the van, but
touring's really different in Australia. You don't really drive because cities are so far away from each other, you have to fly. So it's kind of glamorous. You just hop on a short flight. I took it really seriously. I took my work really seriously as a teenager. I didn't party at all. I never took any drugs. I never drank anything. I didn't even speak to boys after shows. I was just like, I am on a mission. My music is very serious.
That is interesting to me because when I speak to male artists, it's the complete opposite. What is the female experience of touring?
Because I actually wrote an article when I was in high school for Rolling Stone that was like about the male groupie. Like, does it exist? And I was arguing that it actually didn't in the same way. Like, fanboys are kind of not going to turn up backstage and be like, please fuck me.
Yeah.
Fanboys are usually like really nerdy, sweet, or like kind of creepy, but like they're not wearing like a John Travolta like pair of tight pants with the bulge, topless, and being like just knocking on the door like you have to.
That's my idea of an absolute dream. Like, that's my fantasy. Like, I play a show and then John Travolta's there, like, for me.
Me too, but straight men get that fantasy in reverse. really hot chicks literally just turn up to the door like, how about it? I'm like, wait, this isn't fair.
At least I can like get my kicks on Grindr. And even then, it's rare you're going to find like a John Travolta. I found Nicolas Cage level dick. To me, that's like, oh, you're decent, but like every time you laugh, I'm going to look at your face and just be like, oh, wow, no, get me out.
I wasn't quite sure where that was going, but now I know how you feel about Nick Cage.
And do you know what's funniest about that is that they star in a film together called Face Off?
Yes.
Where they swap faces. And John Travolta is the better choice every day of the week.
Yeah, and to tie it all back in, it's unbelievable because it ties in Southampton with Face Off. So X heard that I was going to Southampton.
This is the same day that we met. And it's not Nicolas Cage. Just want to establish that.
It's not Nicolas Cage. And knew that my ex-boyfriend was there and thought that I was going to, like, quote-unquote, check the embers of an... And wrote a song about it called Southampton. And funnily enough, I once texted X saying, like, how good is Face Off as a film? It's just one of my favorite films because it's so whack. And X wrote a really in-depth response saying that they had turned down a role in it and the reasons why it was a terrible film.
My favorite bit in Face Off is when, I think it's John or Nick, but they take their ring and they turn to the doctor and they go, hold this for me. It's such a genius concept for a film. Anyway.
So good.
Enough about Face Off. So I get a text from you one day that's like, hey, I'm on this set. I'm not really sure what the fuck's going on. I'm dropping into London. Can you come by and just like be there?
Hang out.
And I thought, okay, great. We're going to go hang out, going to have some drinks. It's going to be a chill time. I turn up and there's, kid you not, like 200 girls, straight girls. And all white as well. So it turned out this was a Made in Chelsea filming and you were providing the music, which is, you were brilliant, right? Obviously. And you had this beautiful, what were you wearing?
I was wearing an orange long sleeve bodysuit and this thing that I had made with a designer in LA that was pink and black zebra print, taffeta. And we made a giant back bow with the tie of the bow kind of made a train on the ground. YSL orange satin shoes.
Wow. These are Prada, by the way, girl. I got given to these by a lesbian who walked down the altar. These are the things that bring me life.
You reminded me of something really exciting. I can officiate weddings now. I'm like a celebrant. So I can like marry you. In California only though. It's some weird new age hippie thing.
We're going to California. Because yeah. I've decided I'm going to marry myself.
Or me.
Oh, no. Okay. Yeah. I'd marry you, like, within a heartbeat, but...
I mean, I always thought that I would end up married to a gay man and having a child with a gay man because we'd just understand each other and there'd be that arrangement, that openness. Like, we'd have the partnership.
Well, I think this is the future, to be honest. Like, who actually wants to deal with the drama of a heterosexual relationship?
Nobody. I mean, I really don't.
And what's more, I had a weird realization the other day that every time I had straight sex, the woman turned out to be queer as well, because I realized there is no way that any straight woman would actually accept the way that I would like speak to them or talk to them. They just would clock I was gay straight up.
Why are you treating me with respect? That's so unattractive.
Okay, we're at Made in Chelsea, right? Which is its own issue from the start, right? I just remember seeing, like, what's his fucking tits? The blonde guy with the...
I don't remember his name, but he makes candy for a living, right?
Yeah. Like,
and he kept nipping off to the pub across the road.
to definitely smash a line. And here was the worst bit, was the cast of Made in Chelsea could do whatever the fuck they wanted, as long as when the director said, can you just look weirdly across the room? They did that. The audience were literally treated like animals. I remember this one girl, as I walked in, this one girl was actively trying to leave. And the production staff were like, you can't leave. Like, it's going to ruin. Whoa. It's going to ruin continuity.
Oh, my God. See, I didn't know that. It's a weird one because, like, obviously it's good exposure and it's great to have my tracks on TV. And a lot of people have found me through that. But I don't know if you know about, there's a blanket license for television for using songs, so you don't actually get paid to be on Made in Chelsea, but the music supervisor there, who is legitimately amazing and she's got great taste, made such a big effort to try and get me on the show and help me get there, because I was in Texas like the day before at South by Southwest and I was like, there's no way I'm going to make it in time. And they were great. The team is actually awesome. They got a female director for that episode as well. And I actually thought the cast were probably a lot smarter and cooler than they are allowed to appear. And I was fascinated. Like, who was it, Miles and his French girlfriend? I don't know. I so wanted to get involved in the drama. I was like, can we set this up that where, like, I seduce him during the show? And then, like, I was just, like, really wanting to get involved in the drama, but they wouldn't let me.
I remember turning to you and being like, I'm going to go grab a drink. And you pulled me aside and whispered in my ear, you were like, it's apple juice. And at that moment, I was like, holy shit, every drink around this room is either water or apple juice.
Everyone was stuck there for like, I think I performed like 20 times the same songs.
Yeah, that's TV, girl. You got to do it 10 or 20 times.
With no lunch break. I was so sick. Like, that's the thing about touring that I don't miss, is like, I had really reached a peak of like, after 3 years straight of a different city every day, I had a sinus infection that just would not go away because my body was like, you have to stop. Like, you actually have to stop. And I was like, no.
So let's go into those 3 years. Who was that with?
Alex, mostly.
So Alex Cameron, and you were playing keys and singing. How was that experience? He always reminds me, every time I see him, I'm like, oh, it's Roxy Music, that guy.
Brian Ferry?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm always like, oh my God, it's Brian Ferry. And then I'm like, oh no, it's Alex Cameron.
So right.
That's probably an association that he doesn't agree with. But every time I was like, this is Brian Ferry. So how was touring with Alex Cameron and this hero saxophone man?
So I had toured with Alex before when I was 17, and we both were on a tour around Australia, and like, he was hooking up with one of the girls in my band, and he was always so annoying. And I actually, it was kind of that thing where I kind of thought he was hot, but he was just a bit of a dick. And I was like, oh, this guy, like, he's like the one, like the guy that puts your hair in ink in the old movies or whatever, like at school. You know those cartoons, schoolgirls and the guys grab their hair and dip it in ink?
Oh, that guy. Oh, I never put him down as that guy. I put him down as like, oh, I'm going to get my caviar and biscuits out. And like,
no, I found him like that when we were teenagers. He was the drummer in the band. He wasn't the lead singer or anything. But I did hear that he was making his own music. And yeah, one day my cousin was like, oh, there's this guy, Alex Cameron. I'm like, Al? He's making music? And like, I listened to it. I was like, this is really good. And I messaged him and he was like, oh, wow, like, long time no hear. Like, how are things? And then I'd had a big breakup. I was in London. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. And I went to see Alex play at Hyde Park. And hung out backstage, got to see his family and a bunch of old friends that like I hadn't seen in like 10 years. And he was like, do you know how to play keyboards? And I was like, no, not really, but I can figure it out. And he's like, do you want to go on tour next week around Wild. America? And I was like, yeah, I do. So I learned the songs by ear in a week. and basically just hit the ground running. And Alex's style of touring is like, work hard and it will pay off in the end. Like, just keep playing to everyone everywhere. And the touring is almost just to have a place to sleep because it starts to pay for itself. I mean, touring's kind of always at a loss a little bit, but you get free dinners in Europe. You've got a place to stay. You've got a roof over your head. It's like, it was easier for us to stay on tour than to come off tour.
Wild.
Well, none of us were paying rent or bills. It was wild. It was actually fucking crazy. Like, sometimes some of us would have like £3 left and like share it to buy each other a bread roll or whatever. Like, really grim. And it was sometimes, like, no disrespect to like actual war heroes and stuff and soldiers, but it really did feel like, in some metaphor, in being in battle. So just surviving.
It's a very strange world in which you get no time to yourself. So many people rely on you, and equally you rely on everyone else around you.
I really had a fear of being alone once I got off tour. Like, I could not be in an apartment by myself. And I realized I had always had at least 3 people within 1 meter of me 24/7, like literally 24/7 for 3 years at least. Like, even at night when I'm sleeping, there's someone either in the bed with me or in the bed next to me.
Yeah. As a female, how do you explain living with guys? How does that work?
One of them. I don't know. Right. But also, I was lucky because, I mean, I had a very like sensitive new age guy, a bunch of guys. They all had long-term girlfriends. They're all like quite nerdy, actually, and like very interested in being woke or like becoming woke or having like in-depth conversations about things. So yeah, there were challenges, but I think like they appreciated me challenging them on things. And actually, by the end, Alex's crew, the whole traveling crew, was 50-50 by the end.
Wow.
And it really changed the dynamic. It was awesome.
So you were the start of a kind of a change within their ways of working.
Yeah. And I think also like the world was changing, and, you know, Alex's girlfriend probably had a lot of influence over that too. But, you know, Alex is a smart guy, and I think he was just like, yeah, I mean, the world is 50-50. Why isn't our touring crew 50-50? And it started out with female tour managers, and there were tons of issues. Like, there's a lot of horror stories for sure. But I think even that helped Alex and like the other guys open their eyes to that and be like, whoa, you know, our female tour manager got attacked in a parking lot because we left her alone for 10 minutes. Like, Jesus. And she had all the cash on her. Just being like, we can't leave a female tour manager alone in a van. Whereas, you know, you wouldn't think twice about that with a male tour manager.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of speechless at this.
Oh, I mean, there's worse. We were in one night we stayed in a hostel, and we didn't usually stay in hostels, but we did in this random town in Germany with a new tour manager, a guy who I'd never met. We got back after a show at like 3 a.m. and the guys all decide to go out, but I want to get some sleep. And it's the tour manager and I in this room alone together. And I've never met him. And we're sleeping in the same room. I'm like, I don't want to have a shower and come out with my towel on with this new dude from Poland that I've never met. So I went down to the lobby to wait for the guys to come home. And I got harassed by dudes in the lobby. A guy threw a fucking basil plant at me. But then it gets worse, because this guy basically threw a plant at me because I wasn't responding to him. And then someone came out and started playing a djembe. And that's when I started crying, like, uncontrollably. Like, the plant didn't matter, but when the djembe came out, I was just like, I can't handle this anymore.
We had, at South By, we had a tour manager of ours who we trusted. I learned a lot from this guy, and he took such good care of us. And then 3 days into South By, he sends awkward messages to our lead singer's girlfriend, of like special cuddle kind of messages, and touches her on the ass, we fired him straight away. And we were left, you've been to South By, it's an absolute like melee.
Sure.
It's like Mean Girls overload.
I tour managed myself at South By. It was
and I just remember that day, like, we didn't have a sound engineer. We were playing at, you know, one of those venues, like Hotel something, Hotel Vegas, you know, one of the panache nights. And you know what they're like. They're raucous as fuck. And we were like a kind of English, British little indie band with like little guitars. And we started getting heckled for the sound being shit. And I just broke down in the van. I just was like, this is not worth it.
It isn't worth it at all. Again, like, this was just before Made in Chelsea, so I was really sick. It cost a lot for me to get to Austin. I was staying on my friend's floor. She had another band in her other room. She's such a saint. Like, she puts up bands all the time. She'd put up Mac. She put up Roy and I last time we came through. She's like the patron saint of bands.
Yeah.
In Austin. So I was on her floor, and my first show was in the middle of the day outside on the pavement.
Yeah.
And like, you know, my show is like, you know, I did it. I worked the crowd, but I was like, this is the hardest concert I'll ever have to do. And literally, and the worst, and totally not worth my time. And if you don't have a manager or anything, again, like, there is no point. Like, how are you going to, unless you want to go do lines of coke with people and party and stuff. I mean, the idea that it's for independent artists is wrong.
Every year it's more and more corporate. Like, I remember going to see Lemon Twigs at the YouTube room, and they were handing around duck and pancakes. And I was happy for it because, like, I was hungry as fuck, because you don't get to eat on South By. But what I will say is I had a really interesting experience. I was backing R. Stevie Moore at South By the same year that Lemon Twigs were doing their, like, we're about to destroy everyone. That was the most awkward few experiences, because someone decided to put on, as like a vanity project for this huge like yearly barbecue, someone decided to put on R. Stevie Moore after Lizzo. This is 2017, and Lizzo was like, I think this guy had this like moment of madness where he was like, I know what I'll do, I'll put R. Stevie Moore on after Lizzo. I just remember like thousands of people just disappear
I mean, no one wants to go on after Lizzo.
No, but then
I only did two shows. My second one was at a gay bar, which was perfect for me, honestly. Yeah. I was like, oh, thank God. Finally, just some like beautiful gay bears that were just like, yes.
So let's go on to how Holiday works a room, because I've never seen anyone work Moth Club on a Monday night as well as you have. You had the room in a full conga line. The British are very reserved. Not as reserved as the Germans, but we are arms crossed, strokey chin, like maybe
a headlock. I hate that vibe so much. Like, when I was in an indie band, you know what? That's part of why everything changed for me, because I was like, this whole us and them with the crowd and the act, and I'm being cool and I'm listening, and I just thought it was not exciting. And one of my things with live shows is wanting us to all be in the room together. And it's not, you know, one person on stage and everyone else looking. It's like, we're sharing an experience. We're all in this space together at the same time. Like, how do I make it feel like that and connect with people? Because that's the meaning of life, if you ask me. And yeah, I just want to have fun. I mean, this album I spent years writing because I was just like, imagine being Oasis and having to play Wonderwall every gig for like your whole life, whatever band with their one hit. And I was like, I want all my songs to be songs that I'm going to be happy playing for the rest of my life, that no matter what mood I'm in, it will forced me to like pick myself up and like get into a place that's joyful for me and for the crowd. Who doesn't want an excuse to do a conga line? I mean, people want you to give them the opportunity.
I mean, I've been to enough bar mitzvahs in my life to know that a conga line is the answer to all your prayers, Jewish or otherwise.
I've never been to a bar mitzvah.
Oh my God, girl, you're coming to a bar mitzvah.
It's so funny. When I first moved to LA, all the new friends I made, at one point I realized that all of them were either gay or Jewish.
Right. So let's dive deep.
I have a type.
Let's dive into that, because I have a lot of theories about gay Jews. First of all, right, there's a reason why Jews write musicals. And I think it comes down to, at the age of 13, you're forced to learn like this whole song with like intricate melodies. It's not some bullshit hymn, which is like always bom, 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 right? It's like, right? And it's phrasing. And then you have to perform it in front of 200 people. I am not surprised that the Jews write the musicals. Neither am I surprised that the Jews write the films, because at the end of the day, the Old Testament is the biggest drama of all, right?
I actually studied it at university. It's one of the craziest books I've ever read.
Right. And Coen Brothers is the perfect example for me, because as a concept, every film ends with this kind of bizarre questioning of existence itself. And that to me is what a Jewish identity is. That's why I love doing drag and being Jewish, because it's a total like questioning of everything that is set up to be binary. Sorry, I totally disrupted you. And we were discussing your album and how it's something that I definitely identify with, is creating something that people can enjoy, or presenting something in a way that people are allowed to enjoy it. And I think you do that incredibly well. So I guess my question is, what advice would you give to solo performers in terms of trying to create a vibe that allows for enjoyment and allows for connection?
A friend of mine actually asked me this the other day. He had a show in Mexico and he was like, oh, I feel a bit nervous. Like, I wish I could perform the way you do. And I was like, it's so simple in a way. Like, part of it is I've just been performing forever. Yeah. And you know, I haven't performed in 2 years now, so I probably would not be that great right now. Because you do, it is just that, like, when you're used to performing every night, it becomes second nature. And you'll often find bands are at their peak, like, after a year of touring an album or something, right? Like, that's when you should record the album too.
Yeah, I made that mistake many a time.
Yeah, but I think it's about not giving a fuck. Like, just being like, this is my stage, this is my room, people are here with me. Any kind of self-consciousness won't work.
Mm.
You just have to, I just emit love to my audience, and that it opens me. And I know this sounds like hippy dippy, but I would like everyone in the audience to feel like I would love them and make love to them. It's not hard for me, because I genuinely feel like I could feel that way about anyone if I set my mind to it. So it's just about that, and just catching that thing, what do they call it? Ecstasy. It's like that mode when you're not in the future or the past, you're like completely present, but also flowing, like that flow state. It's almost meditative, like you have to kind of tap into it. So firstly, have the songs that allow you to do that, that you feel that way about. Because if you're up there and you're playing a song you don't like, it's just not going to work.
Mm.
And then being really present and in it and feeling every part of it, and letting go of any inhibition, because people like being on edge. I mean, I think that's what we miss about live bands the most. You know, I use backing tracks and stuff because I can't afford a full band to tour, but watching a band knowing that it could all fall apart at any moment is part of the exhilaration of watching a band. Holy shit, that bass player, if his finger just slips, like that note's going to be wrong. Yeah, it was totally on the edge. And I'd like my performances to be like that, which is why I improvise most of it. And I don't like talking. That's what I don't like doing.
Yeah. Picking up that energy, harnessing some sort of flow state where you are so quick off the mark. That's what it is for me. And that's like, I have to get into drag to do that. Whereas you can just
I kind of do too. Once I put on my face and I curl my hair, like I'm ready. I'm in show mode. And if I'm unable to like fully present myself that way, I won't feel that way. Like I need to put on the outfit. I need to do my hair. I put on my makeup because otherwise I don't go into show mode. I don't go into that flow state. And it is like a mask that almost allows you to do that.
That's what frustrates me, I think, a lot about a lot of shows I go to with bands is you may have the best songs, not considered how to perform these in a way that's going to take people to another state.
Yeah, I mean, people are desperate to feel alive. I think we're so numbed. We're on our phones all day. We're like fucking bored, we're stressed, we're like, we're always thinking about the future, we're always thinking about the past. And if you can have someone break that for you by grabbing your attention and absorbing it and changing your energy or making you think about something, that's just such a gift. And that's what we're all missing from live performances. That's such a big part of being human, and like connecting is the storytelling, the entertaining. Like I love being an entertainer. A lot of musicians don't, and that's okay. Yeah. Like they like making records at home and they love making music, and maybe they're introverts and maybe performing is not their bag. Like to entertain and want to entertain people is a whole different thing. Like in my mind, I just think Liberace.
Yeah. I'm always thinking Liberace.
I am.
So I want to move on to, I want to call it asset of yours, but then that might sound a bit dodgy. But the way that you have reformatted some of the traditional ways that the industry works, I find very interesting. So, for example, you funded an album through selling underwear. Yeah. And you've recently taken out an OnlyFans account, which I wholeheartedly support.
Yeah, I mean, I got a royalty check the other day for like $17 for my song was featured on like a commercial TV show in Australia. And I was just like, I can't live. Like, I actually can't. I've got over 1 million streams on Spotify and I made like $12 from it. How am I supposed to live? I can't tour. And yeah, it is a privilege to be able to play music. I'm not afraid of getting my hands dirty and doing any other fucking job like I have many times. But I want to keep making stuff. So that's where I need the money, is to make stuff. And I haven't had interest from labels, and I haven't even really bothered to contact any, to be honest. I've actually never sent my songs to a label to even listen to. So I don't know. I like doing things at my own pace. Sometimes I'm really depressed for a month and I don't want to do anything. I just want to make stuff as I do it and put it out. And I'm just really lucky that through touring, I created a fan base that are really loyal and supportive and like have really pulled me out of a hole many times. Like there was a point last year that was like one of the toughest in my life, and I found a box of records to sell and my fans bought them and it paid my rent for the month. My fans literally saved my ass. Every single one of them. So I just had this realization of like, oh, it's all about people and my fans, and I couldn't care less about industry or achievements or anything like that. It's about making art and taking it directly to my fans. And it's a support system that goes back and forth because I give them something of value. They allow me to keep doing that. So with the OnlyFans, I was just like, this is a place where I can have a subscription for all those fans. They pay like what they would pay for one lunch or cup of coffee or whatever a month. And I can give them stuff directly and it will pay for me to be able to make more stuff, which is the most important thing to me. You know, doing photo shoots and shit costs money.
Yeah, tell me about it. And I'm fed up at this fucking ring light and my little remote control.
And you know what? It is amazing that we live in an age where I can do that. Like I can take a photo of myself and I can put a song out with the click of like two fingers. Like it was never that easy to be an independent artist before. So yes, it's harder in a lot of ways with streaming rates being so bad. Mm-hmm. Like where I used to make $2,000 a month sharing between five band members in the 2000s, like now is nothing for the whole year. So it has changed a lot, but it also, there's just a lot more music. A lot more people are able to just share their music with the world without needing to be part of like the machine. Maybe that's the price we're paying. I don't know.
I think I've been fucked over would be the wrong term, but I've been used by the machine three times in my life. I've gone, oh shit, I was used by the machine.
I'm sorry.
And it's upsetting that the machine doesn't recognize the value of the art that's being created. And so I think there is like a need to go direct to like your fan base. And it's amazing.
And the value system is different. Like I remember sitting in on a meeting with my old label just by chance because I was friends with one of the guys, and all they talked about was numbers.
Yeah.
So, and that's their job, you know, it's a business. And that's fine. It really is. It's just, I don't know. Look, my mom's been making records her whole life independently. So in the 90s, I was lucky enough to see like my mother had an 8-track and a little drum machine, and like she'd make her weird little records at home. And she would pay to get them manufactured on CD, and that cost a lot of money. She'd have to save up for months to pay for that, and then she'd have to take them into record stores individually and try and get them to stock them. And like often they'd just sit there for months, and like one would sell and she'd have to take back the ones that didn't sell, and we'd have boxes of CDs and stuff. But it was a big deal and a lot of energy and a lot of money to be an artist unless you were signed back then. And now I'm just so grateful that there's a way I can connect like financially with my fans as well, like just direct like that, cutting out all middlemen.
And I think it's something that's going to become more and more required for artists to recognize that some parts you're going to have to get your hands dirty. And I think that comes with age as well. When I was in my early 20s, I was regularly calling up my manager, just being like obsessed by streaming numbers or this article or this thing in Enemy or like this festival.
I just was never like that. You know, like my managers, I had really big managers in London for a little while, and they'd be like, what festivals do you want to play? And I'm like, ugh, I don't know. I'm like, I don't even know the names. I don't even like going to festivals. And they were like, what kind of a musician are you? What radio station do you want to be played on? I don't know. I don't listen to the radio. Why do I have to be aware of all this stuff or engage with it? Like, I can still be an artist and not be like, have my finger on the pulse with what everyone else is doing. It doesn't invalidate my work. I'm just a musician at the end of the day, and I make stuff, and I always will. Like, I've been writing songs my whole life. It's not going to change. I've come to terms with that. I think most people who are musical or artistic come to terms with that too. They're like, this is a part of me. It's part of me I enjoy and appreciate. And sometimes others appreciate it too, but maybe they won't. And I probably will still keep doing it. It might not be my career, but it's what I do and part of who I am. So I think it's a really good to come to a place where money isn't actually, like, it's not why you're doing it, or fame is not why you're doing it. Because I think a lot of young kids are all like, I just want to be famous. Like, I'm just going to have it handed to me on a silver platter. No one ever had it handed to them on a silver platter. Like, every major pop star you've seen has worked their ass off. All of them. Mariah Carey, Britney Spears, they came from nothing and they worked their asses off really, really hard. There is no overnight success. Mm. Like, those people have extraordinary strength and commitment, that, like, athletes.
Yeah, it's like, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, it's your life. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, you've got to be happy with the way you've lived your life. You spend the whole thing being like, why aren't I doing this? Why aren't I this famous? Why aren't I signing this deal? Like, it's just going to pass you by. So the bit that you love is making stuff and sharing it.
And that's when you get these really bitter musicians. And I think even the ones that have made it, there's an element of, like, bitterness that's still...
I always found that so weird. It's only ever indie musicians that are bitter, which is so funny to me, because it's like, you're making
you're supposed to be happy with point. Yeah,
like, it's a philosophy. Like, making indie music is a philosophy. Like, when did these guys, like, and I say guys because it's mostly fucking guys, suddenly be like, yeah, but I'm supposed to be famous from, yeah, like, I'm supposed to be making tons of money from my, like, left field art. And it's like, well, no, you're not. You made a punk choice. Nirvana is such a, like, funny one, because, like, they're the beginning of alt in the mainstream, right?
Yeah.
But the whole idea is supposed to be, like, fuck the system.
And then people are surprised when their favorite guitarists actually turn out to be fascists, because from the very start, they were just playing this left field game to try and make a success of themselves.
No, but also so competitive. Indie bands are so competitive. They're like, yeah, oh my, well, did you see that person got that festival slot? And I just think it's so funny, because the term indie,
yeah,
is, I don't know, we've come so far from what that's supposed to mean. And actually, like, I am an indie girl at heart. I have, like, punk spirit. I'm, like, DIY, but I love pop music. So I'm just bringing that to what I make. And actually, I found pop more appealing because it was more free. It was way less judgmental. I mean, you can make any old shit and call it pop.
And people forget the punkness of pop. I don't know why that is, but, like, Madonna was at CBGB's on a regular basis. She is everything.
Also, the only genre that isn't limited. I mean, at any point in time, something could be considered pop. It's only pop because it's popular.
Yeah.
Like, so in that sense, I don't make pop music. I make music that might fit into, like, what was previously perceived as pop, but, like, the stuff that is technically pop now is, like, trap.
Yeah.
It's cool. Everything's changing all the time. There's literally no rules with what gets to the charts.
This is true. There's never knowing what's going to be popular as well. But then there's this very bizarre process that takes place when something becomes popular and then everyone wants a piece of that pie. It's for sure. Like, I remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out and suddenly everyone was writing a fucking mature, womanly sex book. And there are so many artists as well now who are like, Billie Eilish has worked her ass off and everyone's trying to get a piece of that pie.
Oh, like making music like her because it's worked for her?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work. Like, I mean, actually, it kind of does. I have my friend Dan, who you met, the singer of The Feeling, who I lived with, and we used to write together quite a lot, and he would refer to Paper Cups, which are the songs that are in the charts, but kind of you drink out of them and then throw them away.
Right.
They're not like the classics that stay with you over time, but they will sound really similar to the things that are the number one hits. And then suddenly there'll be a flood of songs that sound really similar because people know that will do well because it just, it fits into the playlist, you know. But then you toss it. It's not like the hit.
What is next for Holiday Sidewinder?
I have an album coming out, an experimental album, woo, next month through a label in Australia that was a collaborative project that then is suddenly being put out under my name. But anyway, I'm really proud of it. I like it a lot. And then I'm also writing my actual sophomore record, The Last Resort, which is kind of a dystopian island reggae sophisty pop. My inspiration for it is Paris Hilton's Stars Are Blind. So, yeah.
Oh, my God. I've been watching Simple Life again, and she is just so iconic.
I'm just going to keep making stuff and putting it out because I can't tour. So that's all I can do.
And then the other question is, how does one become Holiday Sidewinder?
You don't, because you can only be you. And that's way better than being me.
Holiday Sidewinder is your actual name. Who came up with Holiday and Sidewinder? Because it's iconic.
So Holiday is from the Truman Capote book, Breakfast at Tiffany's. You know, like Holly Golightly, a character Audrey Hepburn played in the film. In the book, on her mailbox and her suitcase, it says Miss Holiday Golightly traveling in italics. Which is like the curse of my life because I am just constantly traveling. My middle name, Sidewinder, I was named after a woman called Susie Sidewinder, who was the first woman to die of AIDS in Australia. And my mom looked after her while she was dying. And, you know, people were really scared at the time of AIDS. A lot of people wouldn't go near Susie. My mom had Susie vomiting on her and all sorts. And Susie was this like fabulous New York socialite, dancer, like friend of Lou Reed, Besquiat, John Belushi. She was just a really cool, amazing woman. And I'm so lucky to be named after her. So
that's my favorite thing I've heard all year.
Oh, good.
Have you watched It's a Sin, by the way?
No.
It's a drama about how people experienced AIDS coming to the UK, issues with it, and then people getting locked up basically in hospitals because they were considered to be dangers and threats and, you know, the association between gay people and the disease. And it was just
It's fucked. Like, Susie told people that she had contracted it from a bisexual lover, and actually she'd contracted it from drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she felt it was more acceptable to lay blame on a bisexual lover. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
So, and a majority of AIDS cases now are from drug use. She wanted to make something of her experience, and her and her husband made a documentary of her death called Susie's Story that went on the news at the time because her son also contracted it in utero.
Right.
Troy, and he died of AIDS at like 8, and he was my friend, and I inherited his toys. I remember the day the toy truck turned up with all of Troy's toys. But there was so much stigma. I mean, people were literally afraid to talk to her or go near her. And I can't believe what the queer community went through, and just everyone, because we all have a friend that we lost during that time.
That's the thing, is I'm just too young to have been at the period when I would have lost someone that I knew. So it's always amazing to connect with people who have had experience of that.
We're just so lucky. We're in a time now that you can get it under control. Like this guy I worked with came into work so happy one day. He usually super cynical, like quite mean in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, what is up with you? Like, what grinder date did you go on today? And he's like, I never told you, but I have HIV and I've been on an experimental drug trial and they can't detect it in my blood anymore.
Wow. Yeah, amazing.
And I was just like, that is how far we've come. I mean, you can live with HIV now and you can live a long, good life, and actually you can kind of reverse it now. We're so close to that.
And so we bring the curtain down on another Pink Room. It's a jolly holiday with Holiday. Holiday makes your heart so bright. I love you. If there's anything that I want you to take away from this episode, it is to be creative and don't let other people suppress your creativity. Thanks to World of Wonder for their help on this episode. You can head over to ashkenazi.uk to find all sorts of content related to the episode, including pics of me and Holiday and the Susie Sidewinder documentary. Tune in next week to find out what made Fen Lily say this.
I'm going to be a tree surgeon.
And remember, Queens, what happens on tour gets shared in the Pink Room. Ta-ra for now!